The sound of more gunfire made him wince into the mud. He raised his head slightly, knocking it into the barrel of the gun above him. The soldier holding it pulled back enough for him to see another man being dragged from inside the dilapidated yellow school on the west side of the square. He heard children crying inside the small building. The second prisoner was also an Indian, tall with eyeglasses knocked askew on his narrow face. The two soldiers escorting him allowed him to regain his feet before presenting him to the lieutenant. The school teacher straightened his glasses before staring directly into the lieutenant's mirrored sunglasses. Shibalanke knew he was in trouble. The school teacher was deliberately trying to anger the army officer. It could only result in worse consequences than they had already faced. The lieutenant brought up his swagger stick and knocked the teacher's glasses off his face. When the teacher bent down to pick them up, the officer struck him across the side of the head. With blood dripping down his face onto his white European shirt, the teacher replaced his glasses. The right lens was shattered. Shibalanke began looking for an escape route. He hoped that his guard might be sufficiently distracted. Looking sideways up at the young man with the Uzi, he saw that the boy had not taken his eyes off him.
"You are a communist!"
The lieutenant made it a statement, not a question, directed to the teacher. Before the teacher could reply, the officer glanced toward the schoolhouse with annoyance. The children inside were still crying. He swung his swagger stick toward the school and nodded at a soldier to his left. Without aiming, the soldier panned his machine gun across the building, breaking windows and pocking the plaster. A few screams erupted from inside. Then silence.
"You are a traitor and an enemy to Guatemala!"
He brought the stick up across the other side of the teacher's head. There was more blood, and Shibalanke began to feel sick and somehow wrong.
"Where are the other traitors?"
"There are no other traitors."
The teacher shrugged and smiled.
"Fernandez, the church!"
The lieutenant spoke to a soldier smoking a cigarette leaning against one of the trucks. Fernandez tossed away the cigarette and picked up the thick tube propped beside him against the truck. While he aimed, another of the men around the truck shoved a rocket into the launcher. Turning toward the old colonial church, Shibalanke saw, for the first time, the village priest standing outside arguing with one of the search teams as the soldiers stood there holding silver candlesticks. There was an explosion from the rocket launcher, followed a split second later by the blast as the church fell in on itself. The soldiers standing outside had seen it coming and fallen to the ground. The priest collapsed from shock or injuries. Shibalanke could not tell. By now he was feeling the pain in every joint and muscle. The rain mixed with blood on the teacher's face and, as it dripped down, stained his shirt pink. Shibalanke didn't see anymore. The pain had grown until he curled up in the mud, clutching his knees to his chest. Something was happening. It must be because he had never felt such fear before. He knew that he was going to die. The damned old gods had led him to this. He barely heard the order given to move him up against the school wall with the teacher. The lieutenant didn't even care who he was. For some reason, the fact that the officer hadn't even bothered to question him seemed the worst indignity of all. Shibalanke shook as he stood with his back against the already bullet-marked wall. The soldiers left them there alone and backed off, out of the line of fire. The pain had begun to come in waves, driving out his fear, driving out everything except the enormous weight of the agony in his body. He stared through the soldiers gathering for the firing squad at the rainbow forming between the bright jade green mountains as the sun finally came out. The teacher patted him on the shoulder.
"Are you all right?"
His companion actually looked concerned. Shibalanke was silent as he gathered sufficient energy not to collapse to the ground.
See? God has a sense of humor.
The madman smiled at him as if at a crying child. Shibalanke cursed him in the language of his Quiche grandmother, a tongue he had not spoken before his dream of Xibalba.
We dive for the lives of our people.
The schoolteacher lifted his head proudly and faced the soldiers' guns as they were raised to aim.
No, not again!
Shibalanke rushed the guns as they fired. His force knocked the other man to his knees. As he moved, Shibalanke realized in one small part of his brain that the exquisite agony had gone. As the bullet sped to meet his charge, he felt only stronger, more powerful than he ever had before. The bullets reached him. Shibalanke hesitated as they struck. He waited an instant for the inevitable pain and final darkness. They didn't come. He looked at the soldiers. They stared back, wide-eyed. Some ran for the trucks, others dropped their guns and simply ran. A few held their ground and kept firing, looking to the lieutenant, who was backing up slowly toward the trucks and calling for Fernandez. The warrior scooped up a brick from the street and, crying out his name in a mixture of fear and exhilaration, threw it with all his strength at one of the trucks. As it flew, it struck a soldier, crushing his head and splattering blood and brains across his fleeing companions before flying on toward the vehicle. The soldier had slowed its momentum. It was dropping as it streaked toward the truck. The brick struck the gas tank, and the transport exploded. Shibalanke stopped his rush toward the soldiers and stared at the fiery scene. Men in flames, soldiers who had made the shelter of the troop carrier, screamed. The scene was right out of one of the American movies he had watched in the city. But the movies hadn't had the smell of petrol, burning canvas and rubber, and underneath everything else, the stench of burning flesh. He began backing away. Remotely, as if through heavy padding, he felt someone grab his arm. Shibalanke turned to strike his enemy. The teacher was staring down at him through the shattered glasses.
¿Se habla español?
The taller man was guiding him away from the square up a side street.
Sí, sí.
Shibalanke was beginning to have time to wonder what was happening. He knew he had never before been able to do anything such as this. Something was not right. What had that vision done to him? He was involuntarily relaxing, and he felt the strength draining from him. He began to lean against the wall of a peeling pale red house.
Madre de Dios, we have to keep moving.
The teacher hauled at him.
They'll bring up artillery. You're good with bullets, but can you fend off rockets?
I don't know.
Shibalanke stopped to think about this for a moment.
We'll figure it out later. Come on.
Shibalanke realized that the man was right. But it was so difficult. With the fear of death gone, he felt as though he had lost not only the new power, but also his regular strength. He looked up the street toward the forested mountainside, so far away above the houses. The trees were safety. The soldiers would never follow them into the forest where guerrillas could be waiting to ambush them. The flat sound of a shot brought him back. The teacher pulled him away from the house, and keeping his hand underneath Shibalanka's arm, steered him toward the green refuge ahead. They cut left between two small houses and moved sideways along the narrow, muddy alley that divided the clapboard and plastered buildings. Shibalanke was moving now, sliding and skidding in the slippery brown mud. Past rear gardens, the alley turned to a path leading up the steep hillside into the trees. The open ground was at least 15 meters of utter exposure. He ran into his compatriot as the other man stopped and peered around the corner of the house on the left.
Clear!
The teacher had not relinquished his grip on Shibalanka's arm.
Can you run?
Si.
After a frightened dash, Shibalanka collapsed a few yards into the forest. The rainforest was thick enough to prevent their being spotted if they stayed still and quiet. They heard the soldiers arguing below until a sergeant came by and ordered them back to the square. Someone in the village would die in their place. The teacher was sweating and nervous. Shibalanka wondered if it was for their unwitting victim or his own unexpected survival. A bullet in the back was not as romantic as a firing squad. As they trudged deeper into the wet mountain seeking to avoid the soldiers, Shibalanka's companion introduced himself. The teacher was Esteban Acabal, a devoted communist and freedom fighter. Shibalanka listened without comment to a long lecture on the evils of the existing government and the coming revolution. He only wondered at where Acabal found the energy to go on. When Acabal at last slowed down, panting as they worked their way up a difficult trail, Shibalanka asked him why he worked with Ladinos.
"It is necessary to work together for the greater good. The division between Quiche and Ladino are created and encouraged by the repressive regime under which we labor. They are false, and once removed, will no longer hamper the worker's natural desire to join with his fellow worker." At a level section of the path, both men paused to rest. "The Ladinos will use us, but nothing will change their feelings or mine." Shibalanka shook his head. "I have no desire to join your workers' army. How do I get a road to the city?" "You can't take a main road. The soldiers will shoot you on sight."
Acabal looked at the cuts and bruises Shibalanka had incurred on their climb.
"Your talent seems very selective."
"I don't think it's a talent."
Shibalanka wiped off some of the dried blood on his jeans.
"I had a dream about the gods. They gave me my name and my powers. After the dream, I could do what I did in Shipon."
"The North Americanos gave you your powers. You are what they call an ace."
Acabal examined him closely.
"I knew a few others this far south of the United States." "It's a disease, actually. A red-haired alien from outer space brought it to Earth. Or so they claim, since biological warfare has been outlawed. Most of those who caught it died. Some were changed. I have seen them begging in the city. It was bad sometimes."
Shibalanka shrugged.
"But I'm not like that." "A very few become something more than they were. The North Americanos worship these aces."
Acabal shook his head.
"Typical exploitation of the masses by fascist media masters. You know, you could be very important to our fight."
The school teacher leaned forward.
"The mythic element, a tie to our people's past, it would be good, very good for us."
"I don't think so. I'm going to the city."
Chagrined, Shibalanka remembered the treasure he had left in the jeep.
"After I return to Shipon." "The people need you. You could be a great leader."
"I've heard this before."
Shibalanka was uncertain. The offer was attractive, but he wanted to be more than the people's army figurehead. With his power, he wanted to do something. Something with money in it. But first, he had to get to Guatemala City.
"Let me help you."
Acabal had that intense look of desire that the graduate students had when they wanted to sleep with the Mayan priest king. Or, as one of them had said, a reasonable facsimile thereof. Combined with the blood now caked on his face, it made Acabal appear to be the devil himself. Shibalanka backed off a couple steps.
"No, thank you. I'm just going to go back to Shipon in the morning, get my jeep, and leave."
He started back down the trail. Over his shoulder, he spoke to Acabal.
"Thanks for your help." Wait, it's getting dark. You'll never make it back down at night.
The teacher sat back down on a rock beside the trail.
We're far enough in that even with more men, they would not dare follow us. We'll stay here tonight, and tomorrow morning we'll start back for the village. It will be safe. It will take the lieutenant at least a day to explain the loss of his truck and get reinforcements.
Shivalanka stopped and turned back.
No more talk about armies? No, I promise. Akabal smiled and gestured for Shivalanka to take another rock. Do you have anything to eat? I'm very hungry.
Shivalanka could not remember ever having been this hungry, even in the worst parts of his childhood.
No, but if we were in New York, you could go to a restaurant called Aces High. It is just for people like you.
As Akabal told him about life in the United States for the Aces, Shivalanka gathered some branches to protect against the wet ground and lay down on them. He was asleep long before Akabal ended his speech. In the morning before dawn, they were on the trail back down. Akabal had found some nuts and edible plants for food, but Shivalanka remained ravenous and in pain. Still, they made it back to the village in much less time than it had taken them to toil up the trail the day before.
Hunapu found that wearing the heavy cotton padding while he was walking was clumsy and hot, so he wrapped it up and tied it to his back. He had walked day and a night without sleep when he came to a small Indian village only slightly larger than his own. Hunapu stopped and wrapped the padding around himself as Jose had done it. The dress of a warrior and a ball player, he thought proudly, and held his head high. The people here were not like Andones, and they looked at him suspiciously as he entered with the sunrise. An old man walked out into the main path that led between the thatched houses. He called out a greeting to Hunapu in a tongue that was similar but not quite the same as that of his people. Hunapu introduced himself to the Toohil as he walked up to him. The village guardian stared at the young man for a full minute of contemplation before inviting him into his home, the largest house Hunapu had ever entered. While most of the village waited outside for the guardian to tell them about this morning apparition, the two men spoke and drank coffee. It was a difficult conversation at first, but Hunapu soon understood the old man's pronunciations and was able to make himself and his mission known. When Hunapu was finished, the Toohil sat back and called his three sons to him. They stood behind him and waited while he spoke to Hunapu.
I believe that you are Hunapu, returned to us. The end of the world comes soon, and the gods have sent messengers to us.
The Toohil gestured to one of his sons, a dwarf, to come forward.
Chankin will go with you. As you see, the gods touched him, and he speaks to them directly for us. If you are Hak, true, he will know it. If you are not, he will know that also.
The dwarf went to stand by Hunapu and looked back at his father and nodded.
Bol will also go with you.
At this, the youngest son started and glared down at his father.
He dislikes the old ways, and he will not believe you. But he honors me, and he will protect his brother in your travels. Bol, get your gun and pack whatever you need. Chankin, I will speak to you. Stay.
The old man put down his coffee and stood.
I will tell the village of your vision and your journey. There may be those who wish to accompany you.
Hunapu joined him outside and stood silently while the Toohil told his people that the young man followed a vision and was to be respected. Most of the people left after that, but a few remained, and Hunapu spoke to them of his quest. Although they were Indian, he felt uncomfortable speaking to them because they wore pants and shirts like the Ladinos, not the long tunics of the Lacandones. When Chanquin and Bol, dressed for travel in the village's traditional clothing and carrying supplies, came for him, only three men were left to hear him. Hunapu rose, and the other men walked away, talking among themselves. Chanquin was calm. His composed face showed nothing of what he felt, or if he was reluctant to embark on a journey that would undoubtedly bring his twisted body pain. Bol, though, showed his anger at his father's order. Hunapu wondered if the tall brother would simply shoot him in the back of the head at the first opportunity and return to his life. It did not matter. He had no choice. He had to continue on the path that the gods had chosen for him. He did feel a certain misgiving that the gods would have chosen him to have the company of such garishly dressed men. Used to the simple shifts of his people, he considered the bright red and purple embroidery and sashes of these men to be more like the clothing of the Ladinos than to be proper dress for real men. No doubt he would see much that he had not seen before on his travels to meet his brother. He hoped that his brother knew how to dress.
It took much less time to get out of the mountains than it had to climb up into them. A few hours' walking that began at dawn brought Xibalanque and Acabal back into Xipón. This time, the town was crowded with people. Looking at the remains of the truck in the square where most of the activity was centered made Xibalanque proud. Too late, he began thinking about the price the town had paid for his escape. Perhaps these people would not be as impressed with him as Acabal. Acabal led him past the angry stares of some of the townsmen and the tear-stained hate of many of the women. With so many people and Acabal's firm grip on his arm, he had no chance to make a break for the jeep and escape. They ended up back at the cantina, today the site of a town meeting. Their entry caused an uproar as some of the men called for his death and others proclaimed him a hero. Xibalanque said nothing. He was afraid to open his mouth. He stood to one side, back against the hard wooden edge of the bar. As Acabal climbed up and began speaking to the groups of men circulating beneath him, it took several moments of mutual shouts and insults in Quiche and Spanish to gain the attention of all the men. He was so busy watching the men, watching him for signs of violence, that it took a while for what Acabal was saying to make sense to him. Acabal was again mixing Maya and Spanish in his speech that centered on Xibalanque and his mission. Acabal had taken what Xibalanque had said to him and linked it to a Christian second coming and the end of the world as prophesied by the ancient priests. Xibalanque, the morning star, was the herald of a new age in which the Indians would take back their lands and become the rulers of their land as they had been centuries before. The coming doom was that of the Ladinos and Norteamericanos, not the Maya, who would inherit the earth. No longer should the Quiche follow the lead of outsiders, socialist, communist, or democratic. They had to follow their own or lose themselves forever. And Xibalanque was the sign. He had been given his powers by the gods. Confused, Xibalanque remembered Acabal's explanation of his powers as a result of a disease. But even this son of a god could not win alone against the fascist invaders. He was sent here to gain followers, warriors who would fight at his side until they had taken back all that the Ladinos and the centuries had stolen from them. When he had finished, Acabal hauled Xibalanque up onto the bar and jumped down, leaving the stocky man in filthy t-shirt and blue jeans alone above the packed room. Turning to face Xibalanque, Akabal raised his fist into the air and began chanting Shibalanka's name over and over again. Slowly, and then with increasing fervor, every man in the room followed the teacher's lead, many raising their rifles in their fists. Faced with a chant of his name that shook the room, Shibalanka swallowed nervously, his hunger forgotten. He almost wished he had only the army to worry about. He was not yet ready to become the leader about which the gods had spoken to him. This was not at all how he had imagined it. He wasn't wearing the splendid uniform he had designed in his mind. And this was not the well-trained and directed army that would bring him to power and the presidential palace. They were all staring at him with an expression in their faces that he had never seen before. It was worship and trust. Slowly, trembling, he raised his own fist and saluted them and the gods. He silently prayed to those gods that he would not screw the whole thing up. A dirty little man. The nightmare of the Ladinos come to life. He knew that he was not what these people had seen in their dreams either. But he also knew that he was their only hope now. And whether he was the accidental creation of the Norteamericano's sickness or the child of the gods, he swore to all the deities he recognized, Mayan and European, Jesus, Mary, and Itzamna, that he would do everything he could for his people. But his brother Hunapo had to be having an easier time than he was.
Just outside the village, as Hunapu had been removing his cotton armor, one of the men he had spoken to had joined them. Silently, they walked on through the Peten forests, each man with his own thoughts. They moved slowly because of Chankin, but not as slowly as Hunapu had expected. The dwarf was clearly used to making his own way with little help from others. There had been no dwarves in Hunapu's village, but they were known to bring good luck and to be the voice of the gods. The little men were revered. Jose had often said that Hunapu was meant to be a dwarf since he had been touched by the gods. Hunapu looked forward to learning from Chankin. At the height of the sun, they took a break. Hunapu was staring at the sun, his namesake, at the center of the sky when Chankin hobbled over to him. The dwarf's face still showed nothing. They sat together in silence for some minutes before Chankin spoke.
"Tomorrow, at dawn, a sacrifice. The gods wish to make sure that you are worthy."
Chankin's huge black eyes were turned on Hunapu, who nodded in agreement. Chankin stood up and walked back to sit by his brother. Bol still looked as if he wanted Hunapu dead. It was a long, hot afternoon for walking. The insects were bad, and nothing worked to keep them away. It was nearly dark by the time they had trudged to Yalpina. Chankin entered first and spoke to the village elders. When he had gained permission for them to enter, he sent a child out to the waiting party in the forests. Wearing his armor, Hunapu strode into the tiny town square. Everyone had gathered to hear Chankin and Hunapu speak. It was plain that they knew Chankin, and his reputation gave weight to Hunapu's claims. Until they were hushed by their mothers, the children giggled and made fun of Hunapu's cotton armor and bare legs. But when Hunapu began speaking of his quest to find his brother and join him in a revival of their own Indian culture, the people fell under the spell of his dream. They had their own portents. 15 years earlier, a child had been born who had the brilliant feathers of a jungle bird. The girl was thrust forward through the crowd. She was beautiful, and the feathers that replaced her hair only made her more so. She said that she had been waiting for one to come, and that Hunapu was surely the one. Hunapu took her hand, and she stood at his side. That night, many of the people from the town came to the home of the girl's parents, where Hunapu and Chankin were staying, and spoke to them about the future. The girl, Maria, never left Hunapu. When the last villager had left and they curled up by the fire, Maria watched them sleep. Before dawn, Chankin woke Hunapu and they trekked out to the forest, leaving Maria behind to get ready to leave. Hunapu had only his machete, but Chankin had a slim European knife. Taking the dwarf's knife, Hunapu knelt, holding his hands out in front of him, palm up. In the left was the knife. The right, already healed from the machete cut 3 days before, trembled in anticipation. Without flinching or hesitating, Hunapu drove the knife through the palm of his right hand, holding it there while his head dropped back and his body quivered in ecstasy. With no movement except for a momentary widening of his huge eyes, Chankin watched the other man gasping, blood dripping from his hand. He roused himself from his reverie to put a piece of hand-loomed cotton cloth on the ground beneath Hunapu's hands. He moved to Hunapu's side and pulled his head over toward him, staring into Hunapu's open, blind eyes as if seeking to peer into his mind itself. After several minutes, Hunapu collapsed to the ground, and Chankin snatched up the blood-drenched cloth. Using flint and steel, he lit a small fire. As Hunapu returned to consciousness, he threw the offering onto the fire. Hunapu crawled over, and both men watched the smoke rise to heaven to meet the rising sun. "What did you see?" Chankin spoke first, his immobile face giving no clue to his own thoughts. "The gods are pleased with me, but we must move faster and gather more people. I think I saw Shevalanke leading an army of people." Hunapu nodded to himself and clasped his hands. "That is what they want. It is beginning now, but we still have far to go and much to do before we succeed." Hunapu looked over at Chankin. The dwarf sat with his stunted legs spread out before him, with his chin propped up on his hand. "For now, we will go back to Yalpina and eat." He struggled to his feet. "I saw some trucks. We will take one and travel on the roads from now on." Their discussion was interrupted by Maria, who ran into the clearing, panting. "The cacique! He wants to speak to you now. A runner has come in from another village. The army is sweeping the area looking for rebels. You must leave at once." Her feathers shone in the early morning light as she looked at him in entreaty. Hunapu nodded to her. "I will meet you in the village. Prepare to go with us. You will be assigned to others." Hunapu turned back toward Chankin and closed his eyes in concentration. The trees in the background of the clearing began turning into the houses of Yalpina. The village seemed to grow toward him. The last thing he saw was Chankin's surprise and Maria falling to her knees. By the time Chankin and Maria got back to Yalpina, transportation had been arranged. They had time for a quick breakfast, then Hunapu and his companions left in an old Ford pickup truck that carried them south on the road that connected with the capital. Maria joined them, as well as half a dozen men from Yalpina. Others who had joined their cause were on their way to the other Indian villages in the Petén and north to Chiapas in Mexico, where tens of thousands of Indians driven from their homes by the Ladinos waited.
Shibalanke's army grew larger as he traveled down toward Guatemala City. So did the tales of his feats in Shippon. When he wanted to stop the stories, Akabal explained to him how important it was for his people to believe the fantastic rumors. Reluctantly, Xibalanque accepted Akabal's judgment. It seemed to him now that he was constantly accepting Akabal's decisions. Being a leader of his people was not what he had expected. His jeep and his cache had been intact. He and Akabal rode at the front of the column of old and creaking vehicles of all kinds. By now they had collected several hundred followers, all of whom were armed and ready to fight. In Shippon, they had given him the pants and shirt of their village, but each town they rode into had another style and design. When they gave him their own clothes along with their husbands and sons, he felt obligated to wear them. There were women now. Most had come to follow their men and take care of them, but there were many who had come to fight. Xibalanque was not comfortable with this, but Akabal welcomed them. Most of Xibalanque's time was spent trying to feed his army or worrying about when the government would strike them. Both Xibalanque and Akabal agreed that they had come too far, too easily. Akabal had become obsessed with attempting to get television, radio, and newspaper reporters to join the march. Whenever they entered a town that had a telephone, Akabal began placing calls. As a result, the opposition press was sending out as many people as they could without arousing undue suspicion from the secret police. They counted on a few making it to Xibalanque without being arrested. Outside Zacualpa, that word came. A young boy told them that the army had set up a roadblock with two tanks and five armored troop carriers. 200 heavily armed soldiers stood ready to stop their advance with light artillery and rockets. Xibalanque and Akabal called a meeting with the guerrilla leaders who had had combat experience. Their weapons, old rifles and shotguns, could not compete with the army's M16s and rockets. Their only chance was to use the guerrilla experience they had to their advantage. Their troops were split up into teams and sent into the hills around Zacualpa. Messengers were sent to the town beyond Zacualpa in an effort to bring fighters in from behind the government army, but that would take time for the runners to take remote paths and circle back. Xibalanque would be the main defense and their inspiration. This would be his true test. If he won, he was suitable to be their leader. If he lost, he had led them only to death. Xibalanque went back to his jeep and got the stingray spine out of the compartment under the driver's seat. Akabal tried to go with him into the jungle, but Xibalanque told him to stay. The soldiers could have snipers, and both of them should not be at risk. It was mainly an excuse. Xibalanque was terrified that the power would not return. He needed the time to sacrifice again. Anything that might help him focus on the strength he had had before and had not felt since. He knew that Akabal would almost certainly have him followed, but he had to be alone. Xibalanque found a tiny clearing formed by a circle of trees and sat down on the ground. He tried to regain the feeling he had had just before the other dream. He could not find a way to get even a bottle of beer out of the camp. What if being drunk was the key? It had to be the way the graduate students had explained it to him, or everyone with him was dead. He had brought with him one of the white cotton shirts he had been given on the way. The intricate designs on it were done solely in bright red thread. It seemed appropriate. He put it on the dirt between his legs. His ear had healed very quickly, and he had been wearing the earplug for a couple of days. Where could he get blood this time? He mentally went through a list of the sacred sites on his body that were traditionally used. Yes, that would do well. He cleaned off the carved spine with the shirt and then pulled out his lower lip. Praying to every sacred name he could remember, he thrust the stingray spine down through his lip, brought it up part way, barbs tearing his flesh, and plunged it through again. Then He leaned over the shirt and let the blood course down the black spine under the white shirt, making new designs as it flowed. When only drops of his blood were falling under the shirt, he pushed the spine all the way through and out of his body. The sickening copper taste of the blood flooded his mouth, and he gagged. Closing his eyes and clenching his fists, he controlled himself and tried to close his throat to the blood in his mouth. Using the same lighter, he set fire to the shirt, starting flames from the four sides of the stained cloth packet. There weren't any dreams of Shibalba this time, or any dreams at all that he remembered. But the smoke and the loss of blood made him pass out again. When he awoke, the moon was high above and the night was more than half gone. This time, he had no hangover, no pain as his muscles adjusted to forces they were not used to carrying. He felt good. He felt wonderful. He got up and crossed the clearing to the largest tree and struck the trunk with his bare fist. It exploded, showering the ground with splinters and branches as it fell. He lifted his face to the stars and thanked the gods. Shibalanke stopped on the trail back to the camp as a man stepped out from behind a tree onto the bare earth. For a moment, he was afraid the army had found him. But the man bowed to him. Gun held high, the guard led Shibalanke back down to the others. For the rest of the night, the sounds of the soldiers' preparations kept all but the most experienced of his people awake. Agabal paced beside the jeep, listening to the roaring engines of the tanks as they shifted position or swung their guns to bear on another phantom target. The sounds echoed up into the mountains. Shibalanke watched him in silence for a while.
"I can take them. I feel it,"
Shibalanke tried to encourage Agabal.
"All I have to do is hit them with these stones."
"You can't protect everyone. You probably can't even protect yourself. They've got rockets, lots of them. They have tanks. What are you going to do against a tank?"
"I am told that the treads are the point of weakness, so I will first destroy the treads."
Shibalanke nodded at the teacher.
"Agabal, the gods are with us. I am with you."
"You are with us. Since when are you a god?"
Agabal glared at the man leaning on the jeep steering wheel.
"I think I have always known it. It's just taken some time for others to recognize my power."
Shibalanke looked dreamily up at the sky.
"The morning star. That's me, you know."
"Mary, Mother of God, you've gone mad."
Agabal stopped pacing long enough to shake his head at Shibalanke.
"I don't think any of us should say that anymore. It's not proper, all things considered."
"All things considered, you."
They were interrupted by a runner coming in from the town and the sounds of more activity from below. There was another quick consultation among the guerrilla leaders. Agabal went over Shibalanke's part in the plan.
"You're going to be followed up to the bridge by the empty trucks. They'll draw the army fire."
The former schoolteacher stared down into the impassive and calm face before him. Shibalanke felt no fear. There was only a euphoria that masked any other emotion.
"But after the first few moments, they will need more active opposition. That's you. Your fire will protect our snipers in the hills."
His stones had been loaded onto rough sledges that he tied to the back of the jeep and the next truck back in line. As the campsite grew lighter, everyone went into position. The guerrilla drivers started their engines. Agabal walked up to the jeep.
"Try not to get yourself killed. We need you."
He put out his hand in farewell.
"Stop worrying. I'll be fine."
Shibalanke touched Akabal's shoulder.
"Get into the hills."
Shibalanke's move forward was the signal for the column, single wide, on the narrow road, to begin its short journey.
Rounding the corner, Shivalanka could see the bridge ahead and the tanks on either side with their guns pointed at him. As they fired, he jumped from the jeep, the increased weight of his body pounding dents into the pavement as he rolled away. The fragments of the jeep exploded toward him. He felt the power in every part of his body, and the metal shrapnel bounced off. Still, he kept his head down as he scrambled for the sledge with his ammunition. Grabbing the first stone, he threw it into the air and batted it with his empty hand, sending it screaming through the air and into the hillside above the army. It threw dirt on the soldiers, but that was all. Better aim. The next rock was painstakingly aimed, and it broke the tread on the left-hand tank. The one after jammed the turret so that it could not turn. The Indian fighters had started firing now, and the soldiers were beginning to fall. He threw more stones into the ranks of the army and saw men go down. There was blood, more blood than he could ever give by himself. They brought up a rocket, and he saw the man shot by an Indian sniper before the soldier could fire. He was throwing as fast and as hard as he could. Bullets occasionally struck him, but they were stopped by his skin. Shibalanka grew more reckless and stood facing his enemy without taking cover. His missiles were causing some damage, but most of the deaths were from the Indians on the slopes above the soldiers. The men in charge had seen this and were directing most of their fire up the hillsides. Great holes were appearing in the forest where the tanks and rockets had reached. Despite his strength, Shibalanka could not stop the second tank. The angle was wrong. Nothing he threw could reach it. A new sound entered the battle. A helicopter was coming. Shivalanka realized that it could give the army the aerial spotting advantage that could get his people killed. It came in low and fast above the battle. Shivalanka reached for a stone and found that only a few small pieces of rock were left. He searched the ground frantically for something to throw. Giving up, he tugged a piece of twisted metal from the wreckage of the jeep and sent it flying toward the chopper. The helicopter met the chunk of metal in midair and exploded. Both sides were hit with debris. The fireball that had been a machine fell into the ravine, and flames shot up higher than the bridge. The engine on the remaining tank revved up, and it started to back up. Soldiers moved out of the way and began retreating as well. Shivalanka could now get clear aim at the troop carriers. Using more pieces of metal he tore from the jeep, he destroyed two of them. Then he saw something that stopped all his fantasies of being a great warrior. A boy leapt down off the mountain onto the retreating tank. He swung open the hatch from the outside and before he was shot, dropped a grenade within. There was an instant, before the tank blew, when the boy's body was draped across the hatch's opening like a flag across a coffin. Then the flames engulfed them both. As the fighting at the bridge died down with the soldiers' retreat, the Indians began coming down out of the forest and moving toward the bridge. It became quiet. The moaning of the wounded broke the silence and was joined by the sounds of the birds who returned to their nests with the peace. Akabala leapt down the road cut to join Shivalanka. He was laughing.
"We won! It worked! You were magnificent!"
Akabal grabbed Shivalanka and tried to shake him, only to find that the smaller man was immovable.
Too much blood.
With the boy's death, Shivalanka had lost his desire to celebrate their victory.
"But it was Ladino blood. That is what matters."
One of the lieutenants had come up to join them. "Not all of it."
"But enough of it."
The lieutenant looked more closely at Shivalanka.
"You have not seen anything like this before, have you? You must not let our people see you this way. You are a hero. That is your duty."
"The old gods will feed well today."
Shivalanka stared across the expanse of the bridge to the bodies on the other side.
"Perhaps that is all they were after."
Shivalanka was caught up in the rush across the bridge.
He didn't have time to stop for the body of the boy who really had destroyed a tank. This time, his people were taking him along.
The press found them before the army did. Hunapu, Chankin, and Bol stood outside their tent in the early morning chill and watched the two helicopters come in over the hills to the south. One landed in the open area where last night the dances and speeches had been held. The other sat down near the horses. Hunapu had seen the occasional Ladino airplane, but never these strange machines. Another Ladino perversion of nature in an attempt to gain the level of gods. Crowds began to gather around the two helicopters. The camp consisted of a few tents and some old and decrepit trucks, but there were now hundreds of people living there. Most slept on the ground. Many of his people were God-touched and had to be helped to the groups by others. It was sad to see so much pain, but it was clear that the gods had begun taking a greater role in the people's lives even before he had been chosen. With so many who were so close to the gods accompanying him, he felt strong and determined. He had to be following the gods' ways. Maria came up to him and laid her hand on his arm, the tiny feathers covering her, brushing lightly against his skin. "What do they want with us?" Maria was uneasy. She had seen the Ladino reaction to the god touched before.
"They want to make us into one of their circuses, a show for their amusement,"
Chankin angrily replied. This intrusion into their march toward Caminar Huyu was unwanted.
"We will find out what they want, Maria. Do not fear them. They are stick men without strength or true souls."
Hunapu stroked the woman's shoulder.
"Stay here and help keep the people calm."
Hunapu and Chankin began walking toward the helicopter at the center of the encampment. Bol followed, as silent as usual, carrying his rifle and watching the men with cameras as they piled out of the helicopter and stood staring at the quiet mass of people who faced them. When the helicopter's blades swung to a halt, there was almost no noise. The three men made their way through the crowd slowly. They were careful not to move forward more quickly than someone could get out of their way. Hands, paws, wings, twisted limbs reached out to Hunapu as he passed. He tried to touch them all, but he could not pause to speak, or he knew he would never get to the helicopter. When they reached the machine, painted with a large hand-lettered press on each side and the bottom, the reporters were huddled against the helicopter. There was fear and revulsion in their eyes. When one of the god-touched moved forward, they all drew back. They did not understand that the god-touched were truer men than themselves. It was typical of the Ladinos to be so blind to the truth.
"I am Hunapu. Who are you, and why have you come here?"
Hunapu spoke first in Maya, then repeated his question in Spanish. He wore the cotton armor as he stood before the reporters and cameramen. The cameras had begun filming as soon as they could pick him out of the crowd.
"Christ, he really does think he's one of those hero twins."
The comment in bad Spanish had come from one of the men in front of him. He looked across the huddled group. Not even having the man they wanted in front of them lessened their uneasiness.
"I am Hunapu," he repeated.
"I'm Tom Peterson from NBC, Central American Bureau. We've heard that you have a Joker crusade out here. Well, Jokers and Indians." "That's obviously true."
The tall blonde man looked over Hunapu's shoulder at the crowd. His Spanish had an odd accent. He spoke slowly and drawled in a way Hunapu had never heard before.
I take it you're in charge. We'd like to talk to you about your plans. Maybe there's some place where it would be more quiet?
We will speak to you here.
Chunking stared up at the man dressed in a white cotton European suit. Peterson had ignored the dwarf at Hunapu's side. Their eyes met, and it was the blonde man who backed down.
Right. Here is just fine. Joe, make sure you get good sound on this.
Another man moved between Peterson and Hunapu and held a microphone pointed at Peterson, waiting for his next words. But Hunapu's attention had been drawn away. The reporters from the second helicopter had caught on to what was happening in the center and had begun shoving their way through the people to get to Hunapu. He turned to the men and women holding their equipment up out of the reach of his people, as if they were crossing a river.
Stop!
He spoke in Maya, but his voice caught the attention of the reporters, as well as his own people. Everything halted, and all eyes turned toward him.
Bol, bring them here.
Bol glanced down at his brother before starting for the reporters. The crowd parted for him as he moved forward and again as he brought the journalist to join their fellows. He motioned them to stay put with his rifle before returning to Hunapu and Chunking. Peterson began his questions again.
What is your destination?
We go to Caminalhuyu.
That's right outside Guatemala City, isn't it? Why there?
I will meet my brother there.
Well, what are you going to do when you meet your brother?
Before Hunapu could answer the question, one of the women from the second helicopter interrupted.
Maxine Chen, CBS, what are your feelings about your brother Chevalanque's victory over the soldiers sent to stop him?
Chevalanque is fighting the army?
You hadn't heard? He's coming through the highlands and pulling in every Indian revolutionary group that exists. His army has defeated the government every time they've clashed. The highlands are in a state of emergency, and that hasn't even slowed Chevalanque down.
The Oriental woman was no taller than Hunapu. She looked around at his followers.
There's a rebel behind every tree in the highlands, has been for years. Down here in the Petén, it's always been quiet. Before now, what's your goal?
Her attention shot back to him.
When I see my brother, Chevalanque, we will decide what we want.
In the meantime, what do you plan to do about the army unit sent to stop you?
Hunapu exchanged a glance with Chunking.
Don't you know about that either? Jesus, they're just hours away. Why do you think all of us were so hot to get to you? You may not be here by sundown.
The dwarf began questioning Maxine Chen.
How many and how far away?
Chen Qin fixed his impassive black eyes on hers.
Maybe 60 men? A few more? They don't keep any real forces down here. Maxine!
Peterson had lost his journalistic detachment.
Stay out of this, for God's sake! You'll get us all arrested!
Stuff it, Peterson. You know as well as I do that they've been committing genocide here for years. These people are finally fighting back. Good for them. She knelt in the dirt and began drawing a map on the ground for Hunapu and Chunking.
I'm getting out of here.
Peterson waved his hand in the air, and the helicopter's rotors began turning. The reporters and cameramen climbed back into the helicopter or began running for the one in the horse paddock. Maxine looked up from the map toward her cameraman.
Robert, stay with me and we'll have an exclusive.
The cameraman grabbed sound equipment off a technician ready to bolt and strapped it on.
Maxine, you're going to get me killed one day, and I'm going to come back and haunt you.
Maxine was already back at the map.
But not yet, Robert.
Did you see any heavy artillery with the government troops? It had taken only a little while to get their people organized and to find out what weapons they had. There were some rifles and shotguns, nothing heavier. Most people had machetes. Hunapu called Chankin and Bol to him. Together they determined the best course of action. Bol led the discussion, and Hunapu was surprised at his expertise. Although they were facing only a few soldiers, they were at a disadvantage in weapons and experience. Bol recommended attacking the army troops when they came down from the canyons into the savannah. By splitting up their people into two groups, they could best use the terrain. Hunapu had begun to wonder where Bol had gained his knowledge. He suspected the tall, quiet man of having been a rebel. After instructing his people in the planned defense, Hunapu left the drilling to Bol and made another blood sacrifice. He hoped the sincerity of his prayers would give him the strength he needed to use his God-given power and save his people. The gods would have to be on their side, or they would all be destroyed. When he returned to the camp, Hunapu found it broken down, and the half of his warriors who would face the army already mounted. After he climbed up on his own horse, he swung Chankin up behind him. He spoke briefly to waiting Indian warriors, encouraging them and enjoining them to fight well for the gods. Seeing the men on horseback riding toward them, the soldiers had stopped their trucks just outside the mouth of the canyon and unloaded. As the soldiers piled off the troop carrier and the jeeps preceding and following it, they were picked off by the snipers Bol had sent into the bush. Only a ragged line of men faced Hunapu's charge. They were distracted by their fellow soldiers, falling to the left and right at the mercy of the snipers. A few of the older men ignored the deaths and stood their ground against the screaming men bearing down on them. The sergeant swore at them to hold ranks and fire at the filthy Indians. Hunapu's horsemen were unused to firing from the moving animals and were barely able to hold on and shoot. They couldn't aim at the same time. Once the army men realized this, they began taking the horsemen down one at a time. By now, Hunapu was close enough to the soldiers to see the fear and confusion start to evaporate and discipline take over. One man stood up and followed Hunapu with his Uzi aimed squarely at the Lacandon's head. Chankin cried out a warning, and Hunapu was gone. Chankin was alone on the horse, now uncontrolled, and facing the soldier's bullet. As the shots split Chankin's skull, Hunapu reappeared behind the soldier and slashed his throat with the obsidian blade, splashing blood over the soldier's companions before vanishing again. Hunapu brought his rifle butt down on the helmet of a man with a rocket launcher before he could fire into the bush where the snipers hid. Before any of the other soldiers reacted, he reversed the rifle and shot him. Grabbing the rocket launcher, he disappeared and came back almost immediately without the launcher. This time, he killed the sergeant. Covered with blood and vanishing almost as soon as he appeared, Hunapu was the devil to the soldiers. They could not fight this apparition. No matter where they aimed, he would be somewhere else. They turned their backs on Hunapu's warriors to try to kill Hunapu himself. It was useless. Praying to the Virgin Mary and the saints that they would not be next, the men threw down their guns and knelt on the ground. Not all the kicks and threats of the lieutenant could get them to keep fighting. Hunapu took 36 prisoners, including the lieutenant. 20 soldiers had been killed. He had lost 17 men and Chankin. The Ladinos had been defeated. They were not invincible. That night, while his people celebrated their victory, Hunapu mourned Chankin. He was dressed again in the long white tunic of his Lakandon people. Bol had come to him to claim the body of his brother. The tall Indian told him that Chankin had seen his death in a vision and knew his fate. Chankin's body had been wrapped in white cloth that was now stained by the dwarf's blood. Bol stood holding the small bundle and stared at Hunapu's tired, saddened face across the fire. "I will see you at Kabinal Huyu." Hunapu looked up in surprise. "My brother saw me there, but even if he had not, I would go. May both our journeys go their way in peace, or in death to our enemies."
Despite the early victories, both brothers suffered many losses during the rest of the march to Guatemala City. Xibalanque had been wounded in an assassination attempt, but he had healed with supernatural speed. The attempt had killed two of the guerrilla leaders who had followed and taught him. Word had come down from the north that Guatemalan Air Force planes were strafing and bombing the lines of Indians who were leaving the refugee camps of Chiapas in Mexico to join their fellows in Guatemala City. Hundreds were reported killed, but thousands kept coming. The elite, highly trained police and military squads took a constant toll. Xibalanque was slowed, but the mass of people who followed him would not be stopped. At every firefight, they took weapons from the dead soldiers and armed themselves. Now they had rockets and even a tank deserted by its frightened crew.
Hunapu fared less well. His people from the Petén had less experience. Many died in each clash with the army. After a battle in which neither side could actually claim a victory, and ended only when he finally located the commander and could teleport in to kill him, Hunapu decided that it had become foolish to oppose the army and police directly. He dispersed his followers. They were to make their way singly or in small groups to Kabinal Huyu. Otherwise, it seemed inevitable that the government would be able to muster sufficient forces to stop them.
Xibalanque arrived first. A truce had been declared as his army closed in on Guatemala City. Acabal had given interviews over and over again that declared their purpose was not to topple the Guatemalan government. Faced with questioning by the press and the imminent visit from the UN wildcard tour, the general in charge ordered the army to escort Xibalanque and his followers, but not to fire on them unless attacked. Xibalanque and Acabal made sure that the army had no excuses. The country's leader allowed Xibalanque access to Kabinal Huyu. The ruins of Kabinal Huyu were filled with the followers of the brothers. They had put tents and rough shelters up on the low mounds. Looking over the soldiers, trucks, and tanks that guarded the perimeter of Kabinal Huyu, they could look down on the Guatemala City suburbs that surrounded them. The camp already held 5,000, and more were coming all the time. Besides the Guatemalan Mayas and the refugees from Mexico, others were traveling up from Honduras and El Salvador. The world was watching to see what would happen in Guatemala City this Christmas. Maxine Shen's coverage of the battle between Hunapu's Indian and Joker followers and the Guatemalan army had been an hour-long special report on 60 Minutes. The meeting between the hero twins themselves was to be covered by all the major U.S. networks, cable, and European channels.
Hunapu had never before seen so many people together in one place. As he walked into the camp past the soldiers guarding the perimeter, and then past the Maya sentries, he was amazed at the size of the gathering. He and Bol had taken a long and circuitous route to avoid trouble, and it had been a long walk. Unlike the people of the Petén, these followers of Xibalanque dressed in hundreds of different ways, all bright and festive. The atmosphere of celebration didn't seem proper to Hunapu. These people did not appear to be worshipping the gods who had prepared their way and led them here. They looked as though they were at a carnival. Some of them looked as though they were the carnival. Hunapu walked through a third of the crowded camp without being recognized. Sunlight glinting off opalescent feathers caught his eye just as Maria turned and saw him. She called out his name and ran to meet him. At the sound of the name of the other hero twin, people began to gather around him. Maria took his hand and held it for a moment, smiling at him happily.
"I was so worried. I was afraid."
Maria looked down and away from Hunapu. "The gods are not finished with us yet." Hunapu reached out to stroke the down on the side of her face.
"And Bol came most of the way with me after getting back from his village."
Maria looked down at the hand she was clutching and released it in embarrassment.
"You will wish to see your brother. He has a house at the center of Kaminalhuyu. I would be honored to lead you there."
She stepped back and gestured through the crowd, down the rows of tents. Hunapu followed her as she parted the gathered people before him. As he passed, the Indians murmured his name and fell in behind him. Within a few steps, they were accosted by reporters. TV camera lights blazed on, and questions were shouted in English and Spanish. Hunapu glanced up at Bol, who began fending off those who came too close to his charge. They ignored the questions, and the camera crews withdrew after a few minutes of what Maxine called stock shots of Hunapu walking and occasionally greeting someone he recognized. While most of the structures in Kaminalhuyu were tents or houses built out of whatever scrap material people could find, the large twin wooden huts built on a plaza at the center of the ruins were impressive permanent buildings. Their roofs were adorned with vertical roof combs like those on temple ruins, and banners and charms hung from these. After they reached the open area of the plaza, the crowd stopped following him. Hunapu could hear the cameras and sense the shoving for position as he, Bol, and Maria walked alone to the house on the left. Before they reached it, a man, dressed in a mix of red and purple Highland clothing, stepped out. He was followed by a tall, thin Highland Maya wearing glasses and dressed in European clothing, except for the sash at his waist. Hunapu recognized Xebalanque from his dreams of Xibalba, but he had looked younger in them. This man appeared more serious, but he noticed the expensive European watch on his wrist and the Ladino leather running shoes on his feet. It seemed a sharp contrast with the jade earplug he wore. Hunapu wondered about the earplug. Had the gods given it to him? Hunapu was caught in his examination of his brother by Xebalanque's companion. The other man took Hunapu by the shoulders and turned him toward the bank of cameras. Xebalanque rested his hand on Hunapu's left shoulder. In the Highland Maya that Hunapu loosely understood, Xebalanque spoke to him softly.
"The first thing we're going to do is get you some real clothes. Wave to the cameras." Xebalanque followed his own suggestion. "Then we have to work on ways to get more food into the camp." Xebalanque turned to him so that they faced each other and then clasped his hand. "Hold that so they can get our profiles. You know, son, I was beginning to get worried about you."
Hunapu looked into the eyes of the man across from him. For the first time since meeting this stranger, who was his brother, he saw in Xibalbanque's eyes the same shadows of Xibalba that he knew existed in his own. It was obvious that Xibalbanque had much to learn about the proper worship of the gods. But it was also clear that he was chosen, like Hunapu, to speak for them.
Come inside. Akabal will make his statement that our statement will be issued later. Gorge?
The last words Xibalbanque spoke were in Lacandon Maya. Hunapu began to think that this highland Quetzal might be a worthy partner. Remembering Maria and Bol, he caught a glimpse of them melting into the crowd as he walked into Xibalbanque's house. His brother seemed to catch his thought.
She's beautiful and very devoted to you, isn't she? She'll take care of your bodyguard and keep the press away until he can get some rest. We've got plans to discuss. Akabal has some wonderful ideas for helping our people.